This is Alex Gibney, director of Finding Fella, and you're listening to Film Wax Radio.
Hey everybody, this is Adam Shartoff, your host of Film Wax Radio. This is episode number 279. I'm recording this from Austin, Texas. I have not started posting my Austin shows yet. I'm going to do that starting coming up in the next week. But I did want to let you know that I'm going to be doing something a little different. I'm going to keep the intros real short today and put some stuff at the end. But most of the South by Southwest coverage will be in the next few shows or coming up in the next month or so in different episodes. So right now, I'm going to do three segments. The first is with the Zellner Brothers, who have a new fun film that was a big hit at Sundance last year called Kimiko the Treasure Hunter. This is their fifth feature film the brothers have made. They're Austin-based filmmakers, though I did actually interview them up in New York City, and it is one hell of a film. It's one of my favorites of the year, and you'll see why if you go check it out. So I'm going to first talk to the Zellner Brothers. Kimiko opens at the IFC Center on Wednesday the 18th, and then it opens up broader and wider from the 20th on. And then after that segment, I'm going to post the first of two episodes where I'm talking to documentary filmmaker Nick Broomfield. First up is a conversation I had regarding some of his catalog films, from Kurt and Courtney, obviously the film he did about Kurt Cobain and Courtney Love, to Biggie and Tupac, and Fetishes, and a few other films that he's made a little earlier in his career. And they're all now on Fandor. And so that is going to come up second. And then the last segment will be my conversation with the filmmaker Eugene Green, whose film La Sapienza is coming out also this coming Friday, the 20th, at Lincoln Center. I met Eugene last fall at the New York Film Festival, where the film had its U.S. premiere, and the film is being distributed by Kino Lorber. So first up here, let's get right into it. My conversation with the Austin-based Zellner Brothers.
Are you an exchange student or a tourist?
Yes.
アメリカの大陸の奥にすごいお宝が待ってるっていうのが分かって。それ私映画で見て分かって、そこに私の運命があるんです。
I discover treasure right here.
I want to help you. I'm just trying to figure out how.
I was lost once. I saw the light.
It's not fake!
Well, thanks for coming by. This is great to finally sit down with you guys. I've been wanting to do it, actually going back to at least Kid Thing. I mean, maybe even before that, you know, right? Goliath?
Yeah, that was the one before.
Yeah.
No, thanks for having us.
Thank you, David. Let's see. That's David, his voice. And then...
This is Nathan.
Nathan, okay. Well, I might insert it here and there, because three guys, you know, an audio experience might be a little tricky, but...
We sound similar.
Yeah, that happens. But you guys are going to be in Austin in a couple of days?
Yeah, we're heading back.
You guys are... You hail from there?
Yes, yeah. We'll be back there for South by Southwest. So
I was concerned about time. So if you enjoy the experience and we get cut off, Maybe we can squeeze in 10 more minutes sometime.
Oh, sure. We'll see. Absolutely, yeah.
You know? All right, good. Because my show is a little longer format. I don't know if you've heard it, but it's like...
Oh, sometimes. No, we've definitely heard it, yeah. Okay. Love the Claire Denis one.
Which one?
The Claire Denis.
Oh, yeah, I did. Yeah, I was kind of a little bit nervous because, you know, it's Claire Denis.
Yeah, first of all, cool, though. It's good to hear. Yeah, that was cool hearing her talk.
So. Right. And then a second, like, you know, she has a bit of a reputation for, you know, she's a serious filmmaker. You know, the French, they're serious people, you know, when it comes to filmmaking and art making, so as opposed to us Americans. But she was very nice.
Yeah.
Couldn't have been nicer.
That's cool.
You know?
I'm going to ask for a cup of tea real quick.
Yeah, yeah, sure. I have a cup of mint here, by the way. So I recommend it. I'll talk to Nathan.
Okay.
We can talk. Well, we've met, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, you've met, yeah. Probably at a rooftop screening.
Yeah,
and stuff.
I think so. Yeah.
That, I remember the kid thing was in that by that school.
I can't remember the school, but
I don't know. It's in Williamsburg, but
yeah,
I forget the name. It's like an automotive school.
Yeah, that's what it was. Yeah. No, and it was yeah, really neat summertime screening, people out on the lawn, you know, just with blankets.
I know.
It was fun.
Right. Rooftop, but on the ground floor.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's get the Kimiko, the treasure hunter, going anyway, because ostensibly that's why we're sitting together. It's had its world premiere, I want to say, at Sundance. Is that correct?
Sundance
2014. Right. And a year later now, it's having a theatrical on the 6th and 7th. Is 13th?
18th.
On the 18th, excuse me. On a Wednesday? Is that a Wednesday?
Yeah, it opens Wednesday.
Oh, very good. At IFC Center.
IFC Center, yeah.
Here in New York City. And yes. Where else is it opening?
Then the 20th in New York and Seattle, and then expanding from there all over.
So. Has it already had an Austin theatrical?
Yes, it's on the 27th in Austin. Yeah, that'll be at the Alamo.
Oh, okay. So it has not had a theatrical.
It starts in New York, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Very good. Yeah, well, that would make sense, but sometimes there's weird exceptions, yeah. You know, like in people's hometowns, things like that. The demand is so great. Is it showing in Japan?
Be. It has not yet. So yeah, we're excited. Hopefully, we'll be able to get over there.
That'd be neat. That.
Yeah,
because Kimiko who's played by
Rinko
Kikuchi, is of course obsessed with the finding with the film Fargo, and specifically this stashed away loot that Steve Buscemi character buries at the toward the end of Fargo. And so she thinks it's, whether she thinks it's real or not, we're never quite certain what she has in mind, right?
Yes, that's correct.
But she
leave some breathing room for people to interpret it how they want.
Yes, of course, you're right. Actually, I'm so excited, I'm like giving away everything. I try to keep that in mind. And at the very end, did I give away too much, do you think?
No.
Okay,
no.
Good. Okay, because that's, I try to be sensitive to that, but so that's all we'll say in terms of the plot. I mean, that's it, right, David?
Yes, yeah. I think that's the gist of it. Half the film takes place in Japan and half in Minnesota, it, you know, chronicles her quest in search of the fortune. And we always wanted it. We like the idea of structuring it narratively like that instead of the. It has its own, you know, acts and beats within each half, but we really like the idea of it being kind of two chapters. We always love the way it worked because it's unconventional. It's interesting when you change it up, because sometimes, especially when a movie where someone travels from one place to the next, I just feel like sometimes it's like, oh, here's 30 minutes in. It's like, okay, this is when, you know, or they hurry to get out of the first place so they can get to the second. And we really wanted her to be stuck in her world in the first half and really immersed in her situation and her, just everything that she was going through. And so that when she breaks free, you're being released from it.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up, actually, because the first time I saw it, you know, the way that the film was described, much like I probably just described it, it does sound like the majority of the film is about her time in the States and her journey there.
Yeah.
But as I rewatched it last night, I was almost surprised, because I saw it, you know, shortly after Sundance. But I was surprised that I misremembered it. And I thought, oh, well, this is a much longer, where she's office lady.
Yeah. Yeah. I think just because she's kind of like at the beginning, the first half, it's very cyclical. She's kind of stuck in these patterns, you know, and
yeah.
We wanted you to be kind of stuck with her. And then the second half is very linear. I always love the way, like, the structure of Full Metal Jacket is so interesting in the way it's broken into two halves like that. And that was... loved how that worked on its own terms, and so in trying to figure out how this could work, we thought about that.
Yeah, that's true. So it was actually that in mind when you were conjuring it, or was it more just like a...
When we just talked about how it's neat, how that worked. Yeah, just like it's the in terms of figuring out how it works, we loved how it worked there. Mm-hmm. And that kind of has a similar thing where it's very cyclical in the first half, you know, going through this repetition, and in the second it's just mm-hmm. kind of off into the abyss. And so it's fun to, you know, to try different things with the narrative structure when it feels appropriate. So.
Yeah. And Nathan, how did you meet Rinko?
Rinko.
I'm sorry. Rinko.
Yeah, Rinko. We met.
I apologize.
We met Rinko in 2008. Mm-hmm. We had written the first draft of the script, I think, in 2002.
Wow.
And, you know.
Oh, yes. I did remember that now that you mentioned it.
Yeah. After hearing about this urban legend online and all that. That stuff. But yeah, Rinko, we met her in 2008. We'd heard of or seen her in Babel and seen her in some other Japanese cult films and stuff like that. And really, you know, once we met her, we had a really good lunch with her where we talked about filmmakers that we liked and different films. And, you know, she got the tone of the script right away and she kind of understood what we were going for. And you know, after that, we couldn't really picture anyone else in the role. Like, it just seemed like a perfect fit.
Wasn't Scott McCauley originally going to produce it, and then he didn't know what to do?
Scott McCauley and Robin O'Hare were the first people to. They meant a lot to the project because they're the first people to really validate it. And we're, you know,
and since been a big
change. I mean, we've been huge fans. There's for a long time, and so it meant a lot. And we'd been sending out the script for a while, and it just was getting nowhere. And so they're the first people to really validate it. And then years went by before we actually got it off the ground. But it was really nice to have that support.
You mentioned that there was an urban legend about this girl who's. What is exactly the legend? Where does it begin and end? And then where did you depart and go off?
Well, the initial just kind of the kind of seed of the story that we that you know that we began working with was just a little bit of information about that, because it was put online, you know, in end of 2001, shortly after it happened. But this is before, you know, social media with, you know, Facebook and Twitter and that sort of thing. So it was on message boards initially, and just information didn't spread quite as quickly.
We didn't call things viral, unless they were an actual virus.
Yeah, virus stage. So it took, you know, so I think things could kind of get lost in little pockets online. You know, it wasn't where it was instantly everywhere and chewed up and spit out. So I think it was interesting. I think now since what happened was it was initially presented as fact of a Japanese woman going from Tokyo to Minnesota in search of the fortune. And then... We just from that little bit of information, we became, you know, just kind of obsessed with it. One, because you know, when there's little information, you tend to want more. You know, it really piqued our curiosity. And then two, this kind of antiquated notion of someone going on a treasure hunt on, you know, this quest, you know, across the globe for this fortune seemed like something that, you know, conquistadors would do or something from the age of exploration. And especially when it's, you know, it's a hunt based on a folktale essentially. And, although in this case, the folktale was, you know, a film. And so we just love those. We're kind of projected our own parallels on that. And we've always, and also just personally, we've always been interested in the age of exploration and conquistadors and whatnot. So that was something we imposed on it. But we just became obsessed with that and filled in the, and tried to come up with you know, a backstory of what would lead someone to that, and try to humanize it as much as possible, and then eventually, as more information came out, it was debunked as an urban legend, and at first it caught us off guard because we just took it at face value, and, you know, it's like, it's on the internet, it's got to be true, you know. And then, you know, but then we liked it all the more because there's so many layers with this, with the blurred lines of fact and fiction and reality and whatnot, and so that just made it all the richer to us. And we loved that, not only because it was the you know, we're storytellers, we're not, you know, we're not journalists or anything. We were interested in the myth, and that's what we wanted You know, and so that's what drew us to it in the first, drew us to the story in the first place, and that's what you know, the people that were interested online, that's what drew them to it as well. And it was, what was interesting was that there were, you know, different versions of the truth, and everyone and people, all these people that were, you know, since it's online, they were an authority.
Would you have found it more satisfying if there just there had never been a debunking and this was just still, you know, possibly true? It kind of gives you.
I don't know. I think so. I mean, yeah, definitely. If it wasn't debunked, we would have still been interested in it. But it just made us. Yeah. It made it interesting to us in a different way. And also the fact that I think what allows it to live on is that's what people were excited about with it. You know, I think that's what gives the myth still some relevance. Is that the reason why there was attention on that was because of the myth, not because of the true element so much. So. I think that, yeah, that's made it all the mm-hmm. all the more interesting, and we, you know, love the idea of like this kind of modern day folktale.
Though you're listening to David Zellner, and Nathan Zellner's here too, the quieter. I know he's the spokesperson for the brother. Well, and the film actually does, it kind of has a dialogue with Fargo. Fargo opens playing with this idea too, that ubiquitous line based on a true story, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, and we like the idea. I mean,
which is of course there, which is not true.
They
made that up.
Yeah, and so that. I mean, we wanted to be only utilize that in as much as, you know, how it was part of the urban legend. You know, that in terms of the treasure hunt and all that. We the last thing we wanted to do was some, you know, winky homage, like kind of, you know, just or trying to riff on that. Or appropriating things from that. We really wanted, you know, Kimiko's world to be her own world, and respectfully only, you know, reference that as a conduit for her journey.
Right.
Like that's movie world and this is her real world, and that just launches her, you know, on this quest, and kind of leave it at that. And then the other thing that's interesting to us with I don't know, I feel like more than ever, and maybe not, but it feels like more than ever, people, like there's so many films now where it's like everything is, they kind of lend credibility to a film by putting this is based on a true story tag before. And
that's what I was getting at.
And it's always been used, but I feel like I've seen it more and more often now, and it's just, and it, we're to where it's like kind of diluted, you know, it doesn't mean as much because they kind of tag that in anything and then take all kinds of creative license. It's not,
yes, exactly,
you know, that's
right,
not accurate. And so it doesn't. So we just like to, it was fun to just kind of go all the way with it and embrace that.
It also kind of speaks to the fact that there are fewer and fewer original ideas being created because we're, you know, the more you see based on a true story, it means the less we're making up our own stories.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Yeah. Yeah.
Do you guys know, Nathan, those other brothers are familiar or have seen or have...
We don't know if they've seen it yet, you know.
Yeah. They're familiar. Maybe now. Oh, yeah. Okay. That much, you know.
Hopefully, yeah.
Hmm. And so going back, you guys, you made, David, a reference before to Stanley Kubrick and one of his later films, and I'm wondering if he was he an influence? And do you guys share certain influences? Or because as you continue to make, this is now your third or fourth feature... I know you made some shorts. It's your fifth feature.
It's our fifth.
I gotta catch up.
But we've made stuff that people haven't really seen.
Yeah,
you know,
didn't get distributed in any substantial way.
Our first film got distributed on VHS, and we'll still get emails about it occasionally. But when we made it, when Nathan was 20 and I was 22, it just didn't really go anywhere beyond.
What was that one called?
It's called Plastic Utopia. Mm-hmm. It was on 16mm. We made it like right when we were finishing up school, film school, and
where was that?
In Austin. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
UT?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, I went to UT and Nathan went to Texas A&M.
Oh, very good. Is that, where's that?
A couple hours.
Yeah, it's in College Station. Our parents were professors there.
Oh, right.
And I got an engineering degree, but you know, David and I have been making home movies since we were little kids.
Yeah.
We just never, when we started, we never understood the difference between like director or editor or actor or anything. It was just kids with a camera and wanting to play in front of it and behind it. And through that, you start learning how to edit, you know, because we didn't have two VCRs. We just did everything in camera. So.
Really?
And then graduated up to the dual VCR editing system to a really clunky computer interface. And but yeah, we've just kind
all
of...
All before college?
Yeah.
When we were teenagers, it was just basically whatever tools we could get our hands on.
Yeah. So how did you stumble upon the first camera, or like who introduced you to that?
Well, our dad, we had this, like, a Super 8 camera when we were little, and he would do this stop motion.
Yeah. Everybody seems to start with
that.
Right?
Yeah. Like basically animating Fisher Price, figures and that sort of thing. And
it's a great way to start, though. Isn't it?
Absolutely. It's fun. And then
the patience you have to develop.
Yes.
Especially as a kid.
Totally. Yeah. And then seeing the result was really gratifying, Yeah. I mean, that was when we were very little. And then just, we got the family, camcorder. And so just weekends we'd be making, home movies. And when most kids, when you're doing that sort of thing at first, before coming up with original ideas, you kind of just ape, popular movies. So it's a lot of just like riffs on 80s action movies and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, you mean like Stallone movies or
we did a Vietnam vet,
Rambo,
kind of 80, this is 85. And so, yeah, it's Rambo time. Like, Vietnam vet and who becomes a boxer, called When Doves Cry. That was
so it was mixing Rambo and Rocky. But I don't remember being Stallone fans. It was just whatever was in pop culture.
So when did you start taking the filmmaking seriously, or was it because all of a sudden there were Richard Linklaters and then you thought, oh, we can do this? I mean, when did that moment crystallize,
I don't know. Nathan had some other interests growing up, but it was always, I think so. It wasn't until college that he got completely into it, but and then I've always just been obsessed with filmmaking. And so, we just always have been doing it. And there wasn't like some period where we felt like we made some kind of transition. It was just like, we just kept making stuff with whatever means we could, pull together. And then they just, over time became more sophisticated.
Did you guys just bypass the influence stage? Maybe it sounds like,
oh no, oh, we're big cinephiles. Tons. I mean, like a lot of people, I don't know, we're huge Kubrick fans had many formative experiences with his movies when we were young. And so it just, different ages, you have different periods that you kind of go through.
Yeah. Did you guys ever, I know another neighbor, I guess, would be Terrence Malick, right?
Yeah.
Did he have did you have that?
Oh, no. Badlands is so amazing. Yeah.
Of course.
And then, when you're little, it's kind of like the 80s blockbusters that, that was, and then
E.T.
Yeah. And that's all the Spielberg Lucas stuff and John Carpenter and Cronenberg and things like that. And we were very much into horror and special effects. And then we spent hours and hours at video stores, every week. And so it was a lot of just like, you just kind of, just researching, even if you weren't renting something, it was just like reading everything, every bit of information you could gather on the box art, And so just, I think that was a big part of our film education.
In a way, the rise of DVDs was, the greatest part of it, aside from the obvious improvements in terms of quality, over VHS, but it also gave us audio commentaries. And for those film geeks and cinephiles, if you see enough of those, you really almost have like a kind of a master class on filming.
Yeah.
If you're listening to, because DVDs came about early enough where we got a generation of filmmakers, and still that were like, we were talking about these guys, they were all doing these audio commentaries on all their films, and it's been incredible.
It was so fantastic in the early 2000s. We were just devouring those because it's stuff that you wanted. And there, it was before podcasts and that sort of thing. So it was like the only way to get that information. And the old also is more interesting because they were like, dumping everything on DVD at that time. So many older films. And so I think that was the more interesting commentary tracks to us were the ones that people that had some distance to reflect, on the films. I think the commentary tracks that were where they make them, right after they complete the film without the perspective are sometimes less interesting and more technical. But we love the ones where, 20 years had gone by since they'd seen it.
And they bring everybody together.
Yeah, like the Herzog commentaries are fantastic, and the Robert Altman commentaries are
mostly because of the Bavarian sound. Yeah.
Well, like, the Altman like ones are just very candid about what works and what does. It's just so, yeah, fascinating.
I was shot in the gut during this part of the movie. And I sound more like Schwarzenegger.
Well, speaking of Schwarzenegger, one of the all-time great commentary tracks is the Conan the Barbarian one.
Oh, really?
With John Milius and...
Oh, my God. With the two of them?
Oh, yeah. It's like the total comedy team. It's so good. And it's before... It was like very early on. Because I think later... Commentary tracks became more controlled and curated, more just
marketing.
like an EPK, so they were edited down, and everything was there was nothing candid, and everything was just kind of positive. And this one, the Conan the Barbarian commentary track, it's unedited, and it's just this like the most this comedy duo of Schwarzenegger and Milius just. Not knowing what, you know, because they hadn't been many commentary tracks out. They're not, you know, not having some agenda or you know, following some outline. It was just, it's comedy gold.
Oh, that's
for
great.
Anyone
I gotta listen.
That is looking for something like that.
And I'm sure Schwarzenegger must adore Milius because, of course, he gave him his first real break. I mean, he's obviously played minor roles in Schwarzenegger in a number of films, but that was his first real blockbuster starring role, if I'm mistaken. So he probably, and it was a huge success. You know.
And Milius, you know, being, Nathan. Having his background, and he's trying to the mythology of it all, and going into the whole because he's such a great writer, and he took I mean, that movie's so, he takes it so seriously, which is why it works. And then Arnold's just there cracking jokes and talking about how pretty everybody is. Yeah, he's just kind of narrating it. And I think the best part is at the end, because they must have done the commentary track right after Terminator 2. So
Well, no, I think that was just his thing. I think they did it in the late
90s.
Anyhow.
Yeah, but they did the commentary well after, but it was after Schwarzenegger had, you know, gotten huge, and the Terminator second ones were out and all that stuff. And so you can hear him taking his mic off at the very end. It's like, I'm John Milius. Thank you for listening. And I'm Arnold Schwarzenegger. And you hear the microphone.
Yeah.
Bumping down, he goes, hasta la vista, baby.
Gotta get this.
And then walks out.
Wow.
It's really entertaining.
So you have to, folks have to dig that out. And yeah, I wonder if they put those up on somewhere too. Like,
I'm sure YouTube has all of those. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's good to know about.
Yeah.
Because, God forbid we should actually purchase a copy of Conan to hide it. And no, I'm kidding. Well, again, Kimiko the Treasure Hunter, it's opening at the IFC Center on Wednesday, the 18th of March, here in New York City again. And then that Friday, the 20th?
Yes.
In various other cities.
In
Los Angeles.
Yeah, expanding on from there.
And then on there, of course, it'll like a virus, it will
hopefully
spread wildfire.
We have a pretty good release with it. Amplify did a great job. So
Amplify is the distributor.
Yeah, and so I don't know. We're really we're excited to get it out there. Hopefully, people like it.
Yeah, and then also you can see at least two of your other features fairly easily. I think both Goliath, which is terrific, and Kid Dash Thing, are both available through various platforms or whatever. And you can also see some of your shorts online. I know you have some of them on your website, like Floatsome Jetsome. Is that right?
Yeah, we have all our shorts on our
all of them?
Website. Yeah.
Oh, great. And they're also good. I feel bad. I would love to continue, but I got to rush to something. So thank you guys for coming onto the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having us.
Love your work. This is my conversation with Nick Broomfield. I mentioned at the top of the show that it's the first of two. We'll have Nick back on the show in just a couple of weeks, the focus being on his new feature documentary called Tales of the Grim Sleeper, which is going to be premiering in April on HBO. So we'll put that up just in a few weeks. But first, this is a conversation that I had recently over Skype, but it sounds great, and you'll love it if you're a fan of Nick Broomfield's, and as I am. And here it is, my conversation with Nick.
So you ready for a little whipping?
Welcome to the strange.
I'm a professional submissive.
The bizarre.
My name is Slave Jeff, and I am the house slave to Mistress Raven.
The hilarious upside-down world of fetishes.
I want dirty, stinky dinner. pair of shoes.
I have a pair of shoes that you would love.
Ever wonder how the other half really lives?
At 8:40 a.m. on April 8th, 1994, Kurt Cobain's body was found.
The lead singer of the group Nirvana had taken his own life, shooting himself in the head, in the head, in the head.
Can't buy happiness.
He was the center of attention.
He's very nice, very well-mannered, he was.
The world's gonna explode any day.
I'm doing this film about Kurt Cobain.
Do you want to shut the camera off, please?
East Coast, West Coast. East Coast was Puffy. West Coast was Shunite. East Coast was Biggie. West Coast was Tupac. Come on now. You're messing with lives here.
You knocking like you were scared, man.
Scared.
Mr. Cameron, did you say hello to my big friend?
Even though we was going through our trauma, I would never wish death on nobody, you know what I'm saying? Because ain't no coming back from that.
And I make music to bring us together, not to separate us. And all this East and West that needs to stop.
It's an East-West rivalry.
Represent.
Let's make it seem as if Bad Boy Records had something to do with the shooting of Tupac Shakur.
You know, we found 119 IEDs. Every one of them insurgents we miss in Fallujah, they're here in Haditha, waiting for us.
I'm going to raid these two houses right here.
You know what that feels like? To run into a house, when you look down, you're covered in blood and brain. And then you realize that that's your friend, and I refuse to have to go through that again.
How are you doing?
Good, good.
Well, thanks for, I don't know, making this happen so quick. And,
not at all.
You know, because it's kind of funny, because I don't know if you recall when you're doing all your press, when you were in New York, one of your last visits, but we talked about Tales of the Grim Sleeper.
Yes, I do. I thought your face looked familiar.
Well, that was a polite way of putting it. I appreciate it.
No. I do remember.
And we did, yeah. And we've met before. I talked to you once regarding Haditha, too, so.
So we know each other from a ways. Yeah. No, I remember the synetic up in that rather large conference room.
Yeah, that's right. Basically, Fandor, when I saw that they were about to debut some of your catalog, I thought, well, if he's willing to do it, this would be, I think, a nice additional piece to do. I don't know. That was...
Yeah, that would be great. That would be great. Yeah.
Tales of the Grim Sleeper is coming out later in 2015 on HBO. You know, this is a nice opportunity to maybe reintroduce or perhaps, you know, introduce for the first time some of your other films.
Which of the other films they have?
I'll tell you specifically. I have it up here ready to mention, actually. Heidi Fleiss, Hollywood Madam. And I'll just say that that came out in 1995, for those who are listening. Biggie and Tupac, which, of course, came out in 2002. And Fetishes, 1996. And Kurt and Courtney, 1996. And Battle for Haditha, which is...
Well, I'm really pleased they've got Battle for Haditha as well.
Yeah.
I think that's very sort of relevant and timely.
It's true.
Yes.
What's your take on the context and on the relevance for Battle for Haditha?
Well, I feel that there's been very little really done on what Iraq was really about. And the dilemma, not only, I mean, I suppose what's really contextualized at the moment is American Sniper, which is, you know, I think a sort of horrifying film in that it really does nothing other than make an already very polarized situation even worse, with very little understanding as to what Iraq was really about. You know, I think really even from the point of view of the American soldiers, let alone what it was like for the people living in Iraq. And so I do feel Battle of Haditha, which was very much based on the various naval intelligence inquiries as to what happened in that particular incident in Haditha, when 25 completely innocent civilians were wiped out by the Marines of Kilo Company. In the film, you not only try and understand the mindset of Kilo Company, which were all these sort of very young, highly trained guys who were completely unaware really of what the Iraqi population was like, but also from the point of view of the Iraqi people. And I think all that a film like American Sniper does really is compound the issue. I mean, it's quite interesting. They say, you know, the incidence of sort of anti-Muslim violence has increased since the release of the film. And there have been other very sort of disturbing things that have been written about it. So I just feel that Battle for Haditha, which had a very kind of stormy reception here because a lot of people felt it was, you know, unpatriotic and inaccurate, although it was very toned down, at least provides a context to what really tends to happen in those situations.
Well, it's interesting that you say even our soldiers who are there on the front lines and who are actually meeting these Iraqi just civilian citizens, but they still are also buying into the movie version. Where do you think that comes? Sort of just categorizing a whole group of people rather than giving them a chance and getting to know them. And I mean, I thought that's what we were trying to do.
Well, I realized when I was making Battle for Haditha that we were using Marines who had actually been in Iraq, had either been in Fallujah or had actually been in Haditha, that while they were there, they were pretty much confined to barracks. And the only time they ever met any Iraqis was when they were out patrolling. And so there was very little real communication between them. There was no sort of R&R, sort of just hanging out in Iraq, you know, with normal Iraqis. So I think when that happens, when you have two groups of people who never actually get to meet each other, unless it's at the barrel of a gun, unless it's in the conflict situation, what happens is that both sides grow up completely distrusting the other people, and the situation just gets worse and worse. And I think, you know, American Sniper obviously just increases with that. I mean, I think the Iraqis are kind of referred to as savages pretty much throughout the film. And so you don't really advance any kind of real, they're either savages or, you know, even the kids can't be trusted because all they want to do is to grab a rocket, you know, a rocket propelled launcher and fire it. And I think what it does is actually buy into an already incredibly inflamed situation, which has been allowed to be there because people simply do not know each other. You know, there is no real communication or understanding of the culture or the customs or the people by the American troops who were there because they're just so completely cut off and they just live in their barracks and they eat American food and they, you know, from their point of view, they are savages, you know, and it's understandable because, you know, you need to have some interaction in order for an opinion to change. And that's why I think American Sniper is so disappointing because it doesn't, it's an opportunity to advance something and it doesn't advance it at all.
And us at home, what we're getting are the Hollywood version. And of course, all these guys also are making their own stories and sending those back in a weird turn of irony, you know, like, these soldiers are also shooting a lot of video, and there are their own action heroes in these stories.
Exactly. That, I mean, as I say, we used real Marines, and a lot of them had these videos that they'd shot there, and that's exactly what it's like. You know, it's kind of more like being in the Wild West shooting a cowboy film than it is anything to do with what you would expect. And, you know, I just feel that the Battle for Haditha has a relevance because it is with Marines. It's not actors trying to be Marines. It is Marines acting themselves. And very often when I was working with them, they would say to me, we wouldn't do it this way. We'd do it this way, you know, and this is what it was actually like. This is how it went down. So, I feel it is probably pretty accurate in terms of how the Marines operated in Iraq. At the same time, you do get a sense of, because we were able to do interviews with the Iraqi families from that area, their point of view of what it was like to live there and sort of get caught in the middle of the insurgency and the Marines.
Did you ever get an opportunity to screen the film for any Iraqis there? I mean, I guess that would have been impossible, wouldn't it?
Well, showed it in Jordan, where there's a big Iraqi community. And then we had quite a lot of Iraqi actors who distributed the film in Iraq. I mean, I think it was, you know, one of the more pirated films that were shown around there. And there's hardly a good distribution system.
Well, that is the distribution system.
Yeah, I think that is the distribution system.
So they don't get... There's probably not a big subscriber base for Fandor in Iraq then.
Maybe not. No, well, maybe... So maybe this is a waste of time because I wasn't really trying to recruit an enormous number of people to see it in Iraq. I just thought...
I know that, yeah.
It's kind of relevant here.
I think your oldest film in this group it might be Fetishes, right? Is that true?
Probably, yeah. Around that, yeah. Well, Fetishes and Kurt and Courtney, I did Fetishes. Maybe Heidi Fleiss was the first one. But yeah, they were all around that sort of time.
You were making films at quite a clip then, I guess.
Yes. Impending bankruptcy is always a good motivation. But yes, no, I enjoy making these films. They're all so different from each other, and they're all to do with a different, very different sides of that of the world we live in. So they're all kind of fascinating to do.
You weren't necessarily thinking of telling American stories, or were you trying to be more a little bit more universal than that?
Well, I was living here those years, and I did make some of the films in South Africa and stuff, you know, at the time when Mandela was coming out and so on. But then I pretty much moved to California, was living here, and it just seemed a really good opportunity to do some work here rather than always going somewhere else and just coming back. You know, my son was growing up and going to school here. In fact, I remember when he had a school project and he was going to do an essay about Heidi Fleiss, and I was going to helping him going through newspaper clippings and stuff. And I thought, wow, this would actually make a great film, you know. So that's kind of how that sort of thing happens. And I think if you live somewhere, you tend to focus in on things that are happening around you and you make films about those things.
Sure. So it wasn't necessarily a reaction to maybe making something that was more politically intense coming out of South Africa in the early 90s, but you were just actually more making films that you felt were more contextual to where you were living. I guess you moved there because you fell in love, or?
Yeah. Well, my son was going to school here, and I remember, you know, like, this is obviously before Google Maps and all the rest of it. I was continuously completely lost on the freeways of Los Angeles. And I thought, I really ought to do a film here, so at least I'll have to deal with getting around the town.
So you can learn your way around.
Yeah, exactly. Well, obviously, you know, I remember, like every Englishman, I bought this enormous gold Cadillac when I came here, convertible, which was impossible to park and needed an oil tanker behind it because it consumes so much fuel. But I just drove around the city in that, and mainly being lost. But also made a great crew car. And I remember we shot Heidi Fleiss with that. We shot Kurt and Courtney from it as well. And we just did, you know, a whole bunch of films because I became so sort of fascinated in different aspects of, you know, the world that I was kind of suddenly living in California and Los Angeles. And of course, it's a place full of amazing stories.
I can't think of any other filmmaker who really has done that quite in the way you have in terms of the output and these types of stories that are so of the time and so immediate, you know, in terms of pop culture. Again, since you have this new film.
What's that? Tells the Grim Sleeper.
Yeah, which I think is coming out in the summer. Is that? When is HBO? Broadcasting that?
HBO is showing Tales of the Grim Sleeper on April the 27th.
Oh, so it's actually coming up fairly soon.
It's coming out fairly soon. And yeah, that again is a Los Angeles story about a part of the city that most Angelenos don't go to called South Central. And in this area, over a 25-year period, about 200 women disappeared, just sort of like disappeared. Which is, you know, this is like 15 miles from where I live. You'd expect it maybe in a sort of banana republic in South America, but not in the middle of Los Angeles. And I just kind of went, then there's this guy who was arrested and charged with like killing 20 women who had apparently been killing them for about 25 years. And, you know, they think he might have killed many, many more, maybe up to 100 or so. And I just kind of went in with the question, you know, how is this possible in the middle of Los Angeles that this could happen for such a long period of time without anybody knowing something about it? So that's kind of the story, really.
And that question, of course, there's two answers or two levels to it. On one level, it's very obvious. You're asking kind of ironically because they're poor, they're black, they're drug addicts in many cases. And so therefore, these people are disposable. And then on the other level, but okay, but still, that's like 100 people, you know, with people that know them. And how does that actually happen where you cannot know what happens to that number of people, right?
It is really quite amazing. Well, it was kind of like an eye-opener to me, too. I thought I was doing a more conventional film about, more like a whodunit. Did he really do it? Is this possible? You know, all that sort of thing. And at first, of course, a lot of his friends, this is the Grim Sleeper's friend, said, no, he's a really good guy. This is not something he would have done. He's just being sort of framed. And then you kind of realize that this is a much deeper story. It almost transcends, you know, there's a sort of almost overwhelming DNA evidence that he did it. But it becomes like, how on earth is this possible? You know, it's like so many people. And then you realize that it kind of fits in with the whole police thing in places like Ferguson. And I think, you know, in the last year or two, there have been so many cases of either police negligence or killings that, you know, suddenly sort of became much more a part of a bigger story about race relations in the United States, which I never really expected it to be, and kind of absolutely fascinating and amazing that it had that kind of relevance, you know. And I met so many incredible people who were working in this, in that particular world, who've really given a lot of their lives to trying to make things easier or better. And so it was actually a kind of rather amazing experience making the film, which again, I expected, you know, you never quite know when you go into these films, what they're going to be like. But I met a really great bunch of people when I made Tales of the Grim Sleeper, although it probably sounds as though that would be unlikely.
I know, because I was at one of your New York Film Festival press conferences. So, and your son worked on the film with you, right? He was on the camera for a great deal of it.
Yes, the original cameraman we had had been filled full of stories about how dangerous South Central was.
Got scared off.
Exactly, and then he left after about 4 days. And my son happened to, you know, he did a film with, I don't know if you know, Hubert Soper, who did Darwin's Nightmare and We Come As Friends, great filmmaker. They were in the Sudan together, and Barney had just come back, and we sort of ended up working together. At first, we were both a bit dubious, but it worked out really well. And, he did a great job shooting the film.
I know the dynamic between you guys and the some of the people in the film wasn't a tremendous surprise, and how your relationship evolved. I'm excited for the new film, and I think I think HBO is very excited probably because of the timing that it makes this film, you know, that much more relevant in terms of the national. I don't know if it's a conversation or a debate exactly, but it's certainly on everybody's minds. I'm sure HBO is grateful for the timing of it. You know, I'm wondering, as somebody who does have quite a bit of catalog films, how do you, when you move on and you're making this new film, I mean, what do you make of your back films? And does this occupy you in any way? I don't know how it turned out that all of a sudden these like half dozen films ended up on this platform, but how much of an effort do you make to get those other films of yours out there into the world?
Well, I think it's really important because I've known so many really great filmmakers whose work is lost. They would make a great film for one TV company or a film company, and then they wouldn't really keep tabs on where the negative was going or where the masters were going or where the mixes are going. And, you know, film like anything else, you know, you constantly have to rework it, redigitize it, keep it in the best possible technical standard so you can re-release it. And so it's still relevant to today. You don't want to, you know, a lot of filmmakers just ended up with their work on VHS tapes, you know, which now look terrible compared to the amazing quality of digital broadcast now. So I always felt that that was incredibly important. So I think also your work feeds off itself. You know, maybe some people like Kurt and Courtney, and then so they go and see Eileen Wuornos because they know it was made by the same filmmaker. And then if it's easy, they go and watch some of the other films as well. And that way you build up a sort of library of films that people refer to, and all of which work off each other. And I think that's a really important thing. And I think today, especially, where it's so easy to access people's work. And of course, when you've got fantastic outlets like Fandor, who are releasing people's work, like, you know, and I'm very honored that they're showing my work. It lends itself to an audience to look at your other work as well and treat it as really a library and a way of getting in touch with that person's work, you know, on very different subjects. But it's all there. And I've been very careful to upgrade my work. Often we've gone back to the original A and B rolls of the negative and redigitized them. So a lot of the films actually look better than they ever did when they were initially released on 16mm print, for example, or on 35.
It's interesting because I've been doing a series of conversations on the subject of film restoration and preservation. So this kind of dovetails nicely into that a little bit too.
I was really amazed when we redigitized some of the films. Because of the technology now, you can obviously grade within a shot. When you originally did these films, you would just sort of choose the average grade. So, for example, if your camera panned from a very light area to a dark area, you'd have to sort of hit it somewhere in the middle so the light wasn't too light in the dark. Whereas now you can do sort of step digital printing. And of course, it's one generation closer to the negative now when you're going straight from the negative. So you actually see your film today better than it ever looked, which is, you know, really exciting.
Funny, just to respond to something you said at the beginning of this part of the conversation, which is about how I think years ago, obviously now it's decades ago, nobody thought about preserving everything. Kind of, you told the story and then you moved on. Because I just actually talked to John Borman, and, you know, his career obviously goes back quite a bit further than yours. But he was saying how back then they didn't think about preservation. Forget restoration. I mean, they just didn't think about it. So they would just toss everything. Some people went to him about his archives. He says, I don't really have any archives, you know, because I didn't.
It's so tragic. I mean, he, like so many other people, made amazing films for, you know, Granada Television and all these other places. They didn't obviously keep tabs on their films. I always assumed they would be around. Then a lot of the labs went bankrupt, and they just tossed all the negative into scripts, you know, and it was all, like, just destroyed forever. I've had a couple of films that that's happened with, but I was really lucky, which is I used an American lab called DuArt. There's a wonderful man there who's run it for years called Erwin Young, who's really, like, the independent filmmaker's best friend. And he kept everyone's negative. He didn't chuck any negative out. So I'm probably, you know, one of the few filmmakers who has like 30 films and I've got all the negatives still. I mean, obviously, you know, there are a few others that do. You know, I know that people like Penny Baker and Fred Wiseman have been incredibly careful to have all their negative and have archived them. But most haven't.
What's the bloke over at DuArt? What's his name?
His name's Erwin Young.
Okay, good to know. Is he still around?
He's still around. He's probably in his 80s, but he's the most fantastic person. I saw him probably 4 months ago when I was in New York, and he showed me around the lab. It's obviously changed a lot. But he really has an awful lot to do with film preservation in this country and why so many more American filmmakers actually have negative of their work than their British counterparts, most of whom don't have their negative.
Yeah, I'll reach out if you have contact information. I'd love to invite him to talk too.
So. Yeah, he's got a fund of stories too.
I'm sure. Well, The good news is that, as you said, Tales of the Grim Sleeper, which will be broadcast on HBO in late April. You said April 27th?
Yeah, April 27th.
Very good. So what's nice is that people are listening to this podcast when it goes up, of course. When people are listening to this, they'll have enough time to watch all of these other films of yours from your library in anticipation of your new film.
That would be fantastic.
Also, I do have our long, we did a nice, at least 45 minutes last time in at Cinetic, so at John Schloss, you know, his office. And so I'm going to post that on my own podcast, you know, obviously right around the broadcast premiere because, well, that's what it was for. So I'm going to actually have two shows with Nick Broomfield coming up on my show. So I'm very excited.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Good. Well, so nice to talk to you. And I hope Fandor's a great success. I think it's wonderful that they're giving both filmmakers and people who are not so aware of their work a chance to sort of see and catch up with what's happening and what has happened.
Thank you. Thanks for doing this. And hopefully our circles will converge again.
Okay. All right. Speak soon.
Okay. Thank you, Nick.
Next up here is, again, Eugene Green. He is actually born in the United States, I think even in maybe in Brooklyn, but he's transformed himself into a European auteur filmmaker over the years. He's lived in Europe for the majority of time. La Sapienza is his latest film. It tells the story that develops amid architecture, tempered emotions, and artistic inspiration. The title of the film refers to one of the most extraordinary projects completed by Francesco Borromini, the Church of Saint Yves at La Sapienza in Rome. So we'll now be talking to Eugene Green. Enchanté. Eugene Green? Did I get that right? Eugene?
Eugene.
Eugene. Eugene Green.
Mais vous aussi, it doesn't matter.
Eugene. Eugene Green. J'essaierai. I'll keep trying. And La Sapienza is the title of your film. You're having your U.S. premiere here at the New York Film Festival this week. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah. And this is maybe your fifth film or something
yes,
around
it's
there?
My fifth feature film. I've also made three shorter films.
You live in France, correct?
In yeah. Paris.
In Paris. How long have you been, how long have you lived in France?
45 years.
I see. So you're thinking of staying. But your films have mostly take place in France. This one is
well, yeah. Yes, the three first ones take place in France. Although the Le Monde Vivant doesn't take it takes place. It was shot in France, but it doesn't take place anywhere in particular. And the last one, which was released in English, it's called The Portuguese Nun, takes place in Lisbon, and it was mainly in Portuguese.
How does it working in different languages, how does that make the filmmaking process for you?
It's more or less the same thing with the scripts I write in French, and then they're translated. Portuguese and Italian are two languages which I speak, so I even watch over the translation very carefully. And then when I work with the actors, it's exactly in the same way. I just shot, it's not edited yet, but I just shot a documentary in Basque. That's different because I studied Basque a little bit, but it's too difficult to master at my age. So,
oh, really?
All the rushes have been subtitled, and I'll be editing it, but I'll always have a translation, a written translation while I'm working.
Well, let's talk about the film La Sapienza, so we can put your character also in the context. An older couple, the husband, an architect, and she is...
A specialist in social behavior. She's more or less a sort of a social psychoanalyst, that is, groups, human groups.
Right, which is an interesting thing because she spends most of the film by herself. and then they are on a trip, correct, in Italy.
In Italy, it starts in Switzerland,
right.
In Ticino, and then most of it is in Italy, in Stresa, Lago Maggiore, and then in Rome.
And early on, they meet a young brother and sister, Goffredo, and Lavinia, correct? I didn't even say the name of the older couple.
Alexandre and Aliénor.
Aliénor, like the name of this theater where we are now, different spelling.
Almost.
Aliénor, yeah. And they meet this younger couple, and they form a relationship, a very interesting relationship early on, and split up, right? And this is sort of part of what you're trying to get at a little bit in terms of the way they relate to one another. Yes, mm-hmm. is that part yes. of what you're trying to say in the film?
Well, when they're together, there's nothing between them. That's in the first few sequences in Paris. You see them. There's no communication. There's no passion. And it's... only after separating that, through the presence with each one of them of one member of this brother and sister couple, and also through Borromini, the architect whom Alexandre is studying, the Baroque 17th century Baroque architect, mm-hmm. that a bridge is formed, mm-hmm. and that they experience inner change.
Interchange and right, and it's through Alexandre and Goffredo study their mutual love of architecture. The younger student is, of course, just starting off in life and in his career, and is enthusiastic. Alexandre is pushing towards the other end of that spectrum there, and yet when they witness the architecture together, this is also filling up a void in Alexandre. Mm-hmm. Is that fair to say?
Yes, of course. Alexandre is very knowledgeable. He's an established architect, so he explains the architecture to Goffredo, and he gives them a sort of scientific knowledge, but he receives from Goffredo an intuitive knowledge, which he recognizes at the end as being even more important than what he knows.
Mm-hmm. Explain, though, also, as when we're watching some very comical moments, at least the way they're interpreted on the surface, I mean, there is a very broad a scene with when Alexandre and Goffredo want to get into the chapel of this very famous cathedral.
Santivo alla Sapienza.
Thank you. And with one of the guards or one of the administrators of the building, they're trying to negotiate how to get in there. Let's put it that way. And they're interrupted by a very... Well, thank you for not making this character American, by the way, because he easily could have been American. But he's an Australian, which probably, after the American, is the most reviled. Or maybe German... I'm not sure. It depends which part of the globe you're in. But it's intended to be very comical, I assume.
Of course,
so,
because of course. Yeah. Yes,
where were you going?
It's a farce.
Yeah. But it's also especially, I don't know, disruptive isn't the word I want to say, but there's a kind of a very big tone change all of a sudden starting there because, you know, up to then there's large spaces in there in the way Alexandre speaks, and there's a deadpan nature to him. And to some degree, Goffredo as well. And then all of a sudden you have this very comical character. And then you show up later, and then you have a very odd way of speaking, too, in perfect French. It seems as though you're speaking...
Oh, with an accent, though.
Okay.
I tried, originally, we planned on having a real Chaldean, because there's a community in a suburb of Paris, to play the role. But economically, it wasn't possible. The scene is shot in Stresa in Italy. We hadn't got the means to have someone come to study and rehearse with. So I decided to play the role, and I don't know how to speak with an authentic Chaldean accent in French, so I just took a few phonemes that usually foreigners have difficulty in pronouncing in French, like the R and the A, the nasal A. So those two phonemes I distort in a special way.
Yeah.
But otherwise, yes, it's in good. All my dialogues are in very good French. Actually, I don't try to reproduce the way people speak in everyday speech.
Mm-hmm.
But the character, the Chaldean, he represents something from a very far past, because his language goes back to thousands of years. It was the main language spoken in the Near East, in Babylonia and Syria, and at the time of Jesus also it was the language, the daily language of the Jews, and at the same time it's a language which is disappearing, because the last people who spoke it were the Christians of Iraq, the Chaldeans. And there were still a million of them before the war of Mr. Bush, I think his name is. And now a lot of them have been massacred since then, or else they've left. They live now in France or in the United States.
There's a diaspora.
Yeah, a big diaspora. But it's like all diasporas, the language will disappear after one or two generations. And now there are less than 400,000 of them left, and they're still leaving or fleeing because they're being attacked.
So is the film it supposed to be a way for you to also to express your politics as well?
Well, in that scene, there is something political, but it's political more in a general sense about the modern world. That is the fact that in the modern world, we've completely lost the sense of the present time. People don't. For me, the present time is the only real time, because it's a continuous, eternal time which contains everything which has been and everything which will be. But people no longer live in the present because of what is called the digital revolution. And they're always, if you look in the street, people, they're never with the people that they're with. They're always looking at their iPhone or the equivalent, their iPad. And they're speaking with someone who's not there, or they're looking at things which don't exist, because digital images don't really exist. They're just a void.
But to expand a little bit on that, on a broader scheme, why are we turning over our consciousness on some level to digital technology? What are we getting at through that? You know,
because I think it's essentially American economic interests which impose that on the entire world. During the Second World War, most European countries were occupied by the German army, but at least there was something clear. There were soldiers and tanks. There were concentration camps, and then people in the occupied countries either, they didn't like it, but they just tried to live with it, or else they did like it and they collaborated actively, or else they resisted in a positive way.
Mm-hmm.
But today, it's invisible. The occupation is invisible. And so people just go along with it. And there's even a moral discourse, often of people who consider themselves to be progressive.
Mm-hmm.
Who say that it's the direction of history, and you've got to follow the sense of history, and people who don't accept that are reactionary.
What about like in Syria or the Arab Spring or the revolutions that go on in totalitarian governments, where now, because of the same technology, we have cameras that we can share what is happening in real time as well? Do you think we're deluding ourselves in that?
I think so, because it doesn't because images have no more value, so that when before all that, sometimes there would be just one photo which would someone have which had taken of some violent influence, but that would be reproduced in newspapers and magazines, and it would have a great impact because people knew still what the value of an image was. But today, people look at thousands of images every day and they have no more value, and they make no distinction between like what is in a video game and horrors that you see from Syria or other countries where there are wars. So I think that I really don't see a very positive aspect.
It's fair. In fact, I mean, when you describe digital technology in that way, and then what you did several times, you pan across rooms of you pan across architectural space, buildings, walls, what have you, and it feels almost like something that we're not comfortable with, almost, because we're now. But where are we looking? Where are we? What's going to happen in front of there that is supposed to entertain us and engage us? No, we're just looking at what we think of as the background, instead of realizing this is art. This is what's occupying space.
That's what I was trying to do.
Is it?
Mm.
Well, but also I was wondering, I talk more about Alexandro and Goffredo because they're more, in the scenes that we watch them in, they're more actively participating and there's almost like a narrative to it. Okay, you're going to become friends. You know, the teacher gets more inspired by the student. This is something that we're comfortable seeing and used to. Whereas Eleanor, did I pronounce that right? Eleanor is mostly by herself in a few different scenes. She's either walking or she's home, or rather in the hotel or what have you. And Lavinia, the sister of Goffredo, is in bed almost entire time, not well. But there, she's very attached to her brother. Were you thinking about that character and her relationship with her brother and with
Lavinia? Yes, sometimes because of the last scene where they say there's some spectators thought there was an incestuous relationship between them, but that's not what I intended. There's a very close relationship, and Lavinia has the impression that there's some sort of danger, mysterious danger, hanging over her brother, and that she has taken that on herself, and that's the origin of her illness, because she has a sort of nervous illness where she has fainting spells. There's a general theme also in the film of the sacrifice, because Lavinia considers that to be a sacrifice which she's making for her brother. Both adults tell the young people about something in their past life, or they find out about it, about a death of someone, and both adults have a sort of guilt hanging over them because of a death of someone in their past. So there's also, and the young people describe that also as a sacrifice. And there is in the film the idea that the true artist, which Borromini represents, someone who consecrates his whole life to art, makes a sort of sacrifice, but in the same way that in the Christian tradition, God sacrificed himself and put an end that way to bloody sacrifices, and the sacrifice in Christianism is just the sacrifice of Mass, which is without bloodshed, and which permits the faithful to receive to have a spiritual experience. The artist, in the same way, by the work that he leaves, enables people who come into contact with his work to have a spiritual experience, and it can in some ways relieve them of unnecessary sacrifices or unnecessary guilt. It's a sort of purification through contact with art. And the fact that the four characters experience in the film an interior renewal is also related to the presence of Borromini towards the end of the film in a sort of thought or a dream. It's not very clear. Alexandre sees the death of Borromini, which was very dramatic because it was a suicide. And in the representation of that, it's him. He himself plays Borromini, and Goffredo plays Borromini's young disciple Francesco. His name was also Francesco. And after that, he says, "We're saved." And it's the idea that, in a certain way, Borromini becomes a sort of Christ-like figure, but representative of artists in general. And it's through his life and also his death that he makes a sacrifice, and he leaves his work as a sort of secular Eucharist, which all people who come in contact with it can experience.
Did you write the screenplay alone?
Yes, of course I write all my screenplays.
And editing?
I work with an editor, but the main artistic decisions, I take them. And I work with very good editors who contribute also. But, of course, in Europe, it's always that way. I know that here sometimes the director isn't even there for the
editing. They've moved on to other. It's kind of strange, right?
Yeah, for us, it's very strange.
That essentially what an auteur, what we call auteur filmmaking, is, right?
Yeah, of course. If the director is the author of his film, yes, he has to be present in every stage of it. Even if he writes the screenplay with someone, he decides. He makes all the artistic decisions. He has to direct it himself, and then he has to edit it with an editor. But he makes all the artistic decisions, and the same thing for the sound, for the mixture.
Right, the post-production aspects, yeah. And how does it feel to be alongside Godard and in the festival? I mean, I guess you were along many great filmmakers also at Toronto.
Yeah, of course. Well, it's always nice to be in festivals. I don't try to compare when I see in general that the selection of a festival is very high, which is the case of the. This is the fourth festival I've been in consecutively in the Americas, and in the four cases the level of the selection was very high, and of course it's very stimulating and flattering in a certain way to be among them.
Also, like, all your hard work pays off. But you were up at Toronto, and what were the other two?
São Paulo and Rio. I came from Brazil.
How was that?
Well, very good. São Paulo, São Paulo was also a retrospective. They showed La Sapienza, but they did a complete retrospective of my films. And I was really surprised. I had never been in Brazil before, but I can speak Portuguese, so I had a very direct contact with people. And I was surprised by the level of the audience there. It's a little like the audiences we had in Europe in the 1960s and 70s. Young, cinephile and very enthusiastic with a real cinematographical culture.
And they were familiar with your works, in other words.
Yes, many of the people, especially the young people, were. My films have never been released in Brazil, but they've all been shown in festivals, and some of them circulate on DVDs or...
Yes, of course. However people get the technology. But the moment the film ended, or any of the films ended, where you were there getting ready to do your Q&A, as soon as the lights go up, does everybody go on their phones? Or the credits roll, did everybody go on their phones there too?
No.
That's like such an American phenomenon.
When really? They go ahead.
When you screen your film here, is it in the...
Well, I did it yesterday, but it was exception in the very big
Alice
cinema.
Tully. Yes. Alice Tully Hall.
But
that's
people
good.
Were very attentive, and very few people left before the Q&A. Everyone stayed. Almost everyone stayed.
Well, that's what they're paying the ticket price for. for their 20 minutes with Eugene Green and... And also, congratulations, Kino Lorber is distributing La Sapienza, which is good news. So American audiences have an opportunity to see more of your work. And it was a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you very much.
And I hope to have another opportunity again with your, next work or what have you. But
thank you.
Yeah. And if there's any other retrospective, I will be there. You can count on that. Thank you. You know, whenever I go to a film festival, you're hoping for one or two transcendent types of experiences where you go and you see a film and it just totally blows you away. And you never know what that experience is going to look like. You can plan ahead as much as you can, but it really, at the end of the day, you cannot plan for transcendent experiences. They just come or they don't. And interestingly enough, there was a film playing at South by Southwest. I was not planning on seeing it, and it was not on my agenda. And what happened was, like the day before I left for Austin, I got an email through the website by a filmmaker named Trey Edward Schultz, and an Austin-based filmmaker. Young man, it's his first feature. It got at South by Southwest, and he was saying, you know, can you check out my film? And I said, I'll do my best. You know, I responded. I wasn't even going to respond, to be frank, but then I just, at the last second, I just said, oh, I'll shoot him an email reply and tell him that, you know, I'll do my best. And then I ran into him at another screening, and he reminded me that the next day was his premiere at South by. And so I had an interview set up in the middle of that screening time, but once again, something began to nag at me a little later, so I thought, well, let me see if I can push back the interview a little bit and attend the premiere of Trey's film, which, by the way, is called Krisha. So I did, and they were very accommodating to me, and I moved my interview back. And the other day, I go and I walk over to, this is yesterday, actually, as I record this, I walked over and I went and I met a couple of my friends here that I've been hanging out with. I went and I saw this movie, Krisha. And it really blew me away. It is a remarkable film. I guess it was an outgrowth of a short that he did based on the same idea, the same character, but, of course, fleshed out appropriately, by the way, as a feature film. So I just ended up being very moved, blown away by it. And I'm really going to get behind this film. So I'm right now letting you know that it's already, I think it's been programmed to Calgary. It's going to be at Nashville in April. I'm going to be going there, so I actually am looking forward to seeing it again, very potentially, if I have the time. I want to see it again, and I'm very excited by the idea of hanging out with this young filmmaker and talking to him a bit more about his film, Krisha, K-R-I-S-H-A. I believe there's already a website, certainly a presence in social media about the film, so I'm urging you to go check it out. I also saw Uncle Kent 2, and which was directed, well, the first 12 minutes are directed by Joe Swanberg, and the balance of the film was directed by Todd Rohal, who is a filmmaker I really enjoy. He made a film a few years back called Cataclysm, which you may have heard me talk about. And he's back, he's made a couple of films in between, but he's back again now with Uncle Kent 2, which is a sequel to, I think it was like a 2011 film by Joe Swanberg called Uncle Kent, which is loosely based on the first one, on Kent Osborne, who's a friend of Joe Swanberg's. And Kent in his own right is a actor. This is a very meta film, and it goes off the rails. It's really funny, and everybody that I know ended up being in it. It's kind of fun to watch in that regard, and it's been a hit at the festival. So you're going to hear a segment coming up soon with Todd and Kent, which is a huge amount of fun. I'm looking forward to posting that one. I spoke with a lot of people at the festival, everybody. This year, I was managed to really get into quite a few films and talk to quite a few people. I saw a film called God Bless the Child. I talked to those filmmakers. I talked to Bob Byington regarding his new film, Seven Chinese Brothers. This is my second time talking to Bob for the podcast. But what you don't know, unless you're an avid listener of this podcast, is that he was supposed to be on the podcast once before, a couple of years back, with his last film, Bob's last film, Somebody Up There Likes Me, except that my equipment, of course, as you may know, was stolen, and I had not had an opportunity yet to transfer my interview with Bob. And also on that recorder, that Zoom recorder, was a conversation I had with the Austin-based actor Chris Dubeck. So that got lost forever. I did subsequently talk to Chris Dubeck in New York over the course of last year some point. And it's up, you know, you can listen to it. I don't have the episode number in front of me at the moment. But the good news is I actually have brought Chris back onto the show during this visit. But this time he's being joined by another Austin-based actor named Billy Wise. Bill Wise, who, you know, is in tons of Austin films along with Chris Dubeck, including Boyhood. They both have roles in Boyhood and many other films. that have been coming out of Austin. And I also talked to two other Austin-based actors, returning to the podcast Johnny Mars, and for the first time on the podcast, Heather Kafka. So all that is coming up, as well as much, much more. That's just a little bit of some of the stuff. Only some of it, because I have probably twice that much content to share with you in the coming weeks, and I'm just trying to figure out how I'm going to get it all out and edit it all and post it all. I don't know, but I'm going to do it. Thank you for listening to this podcast episode number 279. I'm heading back to New York tomorrow. We'll be enjoying some, hopefully some events at New Directors New Films. And then we'll heading towards Tribeca Film Festival. I'm not going to be around very much for that, so I don't think I'll be doing a ton from Tribeca because I got to go to the Nashville Film Festival. I'm doing a lot this year. I'm trying to submerge myself in the film festival world a little bit more this year because last year I didn't do it at all. So my hope is to bring you along with me. You'll be introduced to lots of different film festivals and programmers and filmmakers having their premieres and that kind of thing. All right. So thank you. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/filmwaxradio or on Twitter at filmwaxradio. You can find our website, filmwaxradio.com. Most importantly of all, of course, iTunes. Please search for us on iTunes. It's called Filmwax Radio. It just takes a moment on the iTunes store to search for Filmwax and click on that subscribe button. Click on a rating afterwards. Rate the show. Give it a star rating. It's crucial. And if you feel compelled to, please leave us a nice comment on the board there. And you can reach me directly through Facebook, through Twitter, right to my email box, inbox, at adam@filmwax.com. Thanks, everybody, for listening. This is Adam Chartoff signing off for Filmwax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films. Until next time, everybody, take care.
That the dice are loaded, everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guy's lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows. Everybody knows that the boat is leaking. Everybody knows the captain lied. Everybody got this broken feeling, like their father or their dog just died. Everybody talking to their pockets. Everybody wants. Bob's in charge.